morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Customer Service and Operations and Security Committee to order. Before I start, let me just ask Mr. Levin to please provide us a safety contact for the morning.
Good morning. In the event of an emergency, you're going to egress to the main doors to the closest exit. They're illuminated by exit signs. We're going to assemble at the lawn of the National Building Museum, and automatic external defibrillator is available behind the guard station. Fire extinguishers are strategically placed throughout the building. Restrooms are past the guard desk on the left. The safety contact for today is avoiding back pain. Good morning. This month is National Safety Month. According to the National Safety Council, about 80% of the U.S. population will experience back pain issues at some point in their lives, and 31 million will experience lower back pain at any given time. Most of these aches and pains are not caused by serious underlying conditions, but from actions like improper lifting techniques. To prevent strains, dislocations, and muscle tears when lifting, make sure you stretch and warm up before you perform any lifting. Ensure you are on solid ground with your feet spread shoulder-width apart. Keep your back straight and bend your knees. Lift with your legs, not your back. Keep the box or object close to your body. Lift the amount of weight you're able to handle. Separate boxes and make two trips instead of trying to carry more than you can handle. Prevent lower back pain by staying healthy and active. Carrying extra body weight and smoking can make you more susceptible to back injuries. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Levin. To go through today's agenda, let's start by, are there any comments to the agenda? None? If so, I consider accepted. May I have a motion for approval of the minutes? Mr. Lobby, is there a second? I hear a second. Thank you.
Second.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? Minutes are adopted. Today we have three information items, and the first item on the agenda is Chief Operating Officer Joe Leader will provide the committee with an overview of the efforts to reduce fare evasion on our Metro Rail and Metro Bus and initial results of the fare share pilot in which that was placed at the Gallery Place and Fort Todd and Metro Rail stations. The second information item will be given to update us on the progress in implementing improvements to the Metro Rail Operations and Control Center, or the ROC as we call it. And the final one will be for Mr. Off, Assistant General Manager on Rail Service, and Laurie Mason, Chief Maintenance of Bay and Engineering. And we will review the accomplishments of the year-long Safe Track program through the surge of 14. Mr. Off also will describe the Metro's new approach to maintenance, and this is information that we've gathered as the input we provided in regarding measurements that we've been using, and provide and describe Metro's new approach for maintenance and major capital projects for FY18. And we will start with the fare pilot information item.
Okay, good morning. The purpose of today's presentation is to provide an overview of the Fair Share Initiative and findings from the pilot, where we tested more secure configurations of our swing gates at Fort Totten and Gallery Place Metro Rail stations. This pilot and other efforts to reduce fare evasion are designed to improve the safety of our employees and our customers, increase revenue collection, and provide more accurate fare box ridership counts. Fare evasion is a multi-dimensional problem for us. It is the greatest cause of conflict between our customers and our employees. It creates fairness issues among customers. Nearly all riders, 92%, said they support Metro cracking down on fare evasion as a way to realize the additional funds each year. We lose revenue when people don't pay. We need to address and reduce the ways some customers knowingly act to beat the fare. Fare evasion reduces our fare box ridership counts, and accurate ridership counts are important for us as we continue to build accurate schedules. And the police have found fare evasion linked to more serious crimes. People stopped or checked through the National Law Enforcement Database, and some have come up with open warrants which have led to their arrest. The pilot program is not intended or expected to solve our fare evasion problem on its own. Rather, It targets our weakest point, the swing gate, where we see the highest level of fare evasion. Over the past 2 years, Metro has eliminated paper fare cards, and worked over the last several months with Metro Access customers and their companions to replace the flash passes with smart trip cards. In addition, some students in the DC Kids Ride program previously had flash passes. Now all students are required to tap their DC1 cards to ride. So all passengers should now tap to enter and exit our system on the rail side and tap in on our bus side. These efforts have largely eliminated the need for customers to access the swing gates except in the event of an emergency. We are continuing to reinforce the requirement for all employees to tap badges when going in and out of our stations and not use the swing gates. In regards to employee assaults and our current police enforcement, through May of this year, 5,499 enforcement actions have occurred compared to 2,618 the same period last year. We are conducting bus operator assault town hall meetings with employees as well as outreach to the community, such as Respect Your Ride events. Bus operator shields and video monitors have been successful at reducing incidents and conflict and will now be installed on all buses, both new and rehabilitated buses. Bus shields are now installed on 500 buses, and all new and overhauled buses in the future will have them. So that means each year, 100 new and 100 rehab buses will now have bus shields. Every bus has cameras. However, after a successful pilot of video monitors playing back camera images on the X2 line, where we saw operator assaults and other incidents decrease significantly, we are expanding the video monitoring pilot system-wide. So all new buses coming in the future will now have video monitors on them. The Fair Share pilot was developed to address the issue of swing gate usage in the Metro Rail system. The pilot began on May 1st, 2017 at Fort Totten and Gallery Place stations. The goal of the pilot was to determine if the program would be effective in changing customer behavior and reduce fare evasion. The two pilot stations have a total of 7 swing gates, 5 at Gallery Place and 2 at Fort Totten. Fort Totten's gates have been secured during the pilot. At Gallery, the swing gates include both secured and what we call gate stop configurations, which we'll discuss on the next slide. In addition, the Fair Share pilot includes new gate signage, employee and customer education, and police enforcement. Station managers at the pilot stations have been trained to use the new equipment and to make exceptions to entry through the swing gate under limited circumstances. During the Fair Share pilot, additional Metro Transit police officers have been deployed to the pilot stations to assist with law enforcement. This supplements MTPD's regularly conducted targeted efforts to enforce fare regulations in both Metro Rail and Metro Bus. We tested 2 configurations. The configurations used on each gate was determined by ADA requirements, mezzanine design, and the number of gates. The gate stop configuration has an unsecured gate stop that allows the gate to open in the direction of exit only. The secured configuration has one of two gates secured with a push-to-open bar that sets off an alarm when pushed, and a card swipe for use by the station manager or a certain customer requesting special accommodation. If there are 2 gates on the same array, they share both a card swipe as well as a keypad. At this time, we have a video we'd like to show you. We have a before and an after video showing the condition at Fort Totten before we launched the pilot and the first week after it went live. Both videos were taken during the evening rush on a Wednesday at the same time, and I think you'll notice the difference. This is the before. conducted a sampling of 4 hours of CCTV at Fort Totten before and after the pilot on the same dates that you saw in the video. We saw that the new configuration reduced improper use of the swing gates by 91%. Station managers are generally supportive of the effort, and fare evasion has been a big complaint among staff for a long time. The general message is that it helps. It doesn't solve the problem totally, but it helps. Some people are still finding other ways, but it's a good start and worth expanding to other stations. Customers consistently tell us that they are overwhelmingly supporting the crackdown on fare evasion. During our budget outreach last year, 92% of our customers said they wanted us to reduce fare evasion as a way to realize additional funds each year. What are our next steps? Implement the fare share program at 20 additional stations, which are still under consideration but will be across all three jurisdictions. We are looking at solutions for other common fare evasion station areas beyond the fare gate areas. We also want to continue the MTPD enforcement efforts that are ongoing. When it comes to the estimate of fare evasion in our agency, like many other agencies, no one has an exact number. Most agencies, when you contact them, will give you a range, and the range is pretty large. I would say ours is in the tens of millions, but we do not know. And what we'd like to do is to expand the program and begin the research to figure out how much fare evasion we have in our system. And finally, we want to continue promoting our fare products, passes, and online loading options to our customers. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Leader. I think the opportunity to really see this really shows how, by not doing something about it, kind of approves a culture that it's a loss of revenue, but it is a culture. And so I think that this has been a really good opportunity to see us spread forward. Are there any questions regarding the presentation? None? Yet, Mr. Wabi?
Just a short question. When we saw the video, the second video, was that the gate stop configuration or was that the alarmed?
That was the alarmed.
That was the alarmed.
Yes.
And moving forward, you're looking to put the alarmed gates in. Is that correct?
Right now, based on the layout of the configuration, it would have to be designed. Some stations will get the alarm. Some will have a combination of alarmed and the gate stop. As we move forward and we redo our AFC system, we may be able to change the layout of our AFC, and we'll be able to expand it where all gates could become alarmed.
So, okay. But to begin with, you'll use a combination of both.
Correct.
Thank you.
Because they're station structures.
Yes.
Right. The entrances in some stations mm-hmm. are different. Okay. Thank you very much. And let's move on now to the second item that we have for Mr. Lehmer on the implementation of the Metro.
Before I start with my presentation, I'd just like to introduce a staff member. Lisa Woodruff is a 24-year veteran here at Washington Metro. She's the managing director of our rail transportation group, which oversees not only our train operators, our station managers, but the ROC as well. And I brought her here just in case I can't answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Okay.
Good morning. The purpose of today's presentation is to update the board on a program already underway to improve the Rail Operations Control Center. The program focuses on strengthening the ROC's safety culture, management, workflow, and making critical process changes. Safety and rail executives have united to restructure work, beef up constant supervision, reduce distractions, enhance training and procedures, and address retention and turnover with inside the ROC. Metro developed this plan based on various site visits to other agency control centers. Many of these challenge areas have been the subject of reviews and corrective actions by the NTSB, the FTA, as well as TOC. And we have a slide later to show you some of the caps. The ROC plays a critical role in the safe and efficient operation of Metro Rail. Most in this room have probably never served in a similar environment such as the ROC, where the environment can quickly transition from a quiet routine atmosphere to constantly having to respond to an incident or emergency that requires intense focus, command, and control. I spent countless hours in a control center environment and served also as a volunteer fireman, and through these experiences know what these employees have to deal with on a daily basis. These are high-stress jobs with little to no margin for error. Mistakes cannot be tolerated, and auditing and performance on an ongoing basis is key. Training alone does not make a good controller. Training combined with experience and the right personal characteristics, temperament, and disposition all contribute to making a good controller. A number of things have influenced the ROC over the last few years. As Metrorail has grown from its original 4.2 miles to today's 118 miles and nearly 200 million annual trips, the operations in the ROC and the work of the controllers has become much more complex. After the 2009 collision, the rail system has been manually managed, which has added to the workload of the controllers as they manually manage headways and properly interweave trains at junctions to keep service on time. The opening of the Silver Line in 2014 created additional junctions to manage. In addition, controllers are also involved in the significant increase in corrective and preventive maintenance occurring on the system, leading to single tracking, speed restrictions, and other special operating conditions. Turnover in staff is also an additional challenge we need to manage when it comes to managing the forces that affect the ROC environment. Actions are underway to restructure work to decrease controller territory and therefore workload. First, we are adding a fourth radio channel console known as Ops 4. This will move 13 stations, one rail yard, and one junction away from the existing consoles, whose area of responsibility had grown with the expansion of the system, most recently the opening of the Silver Line. 11 new ROC supervisors have already been hired and started their 25-week training program. Metro will have ample staff to open the Ops 4 radio channel console. The additional staff will also provide the ROC with staff to implement breaks and reliefs. Additionally, Metro has recruited to date 7 new maintenance-away control supervisors for various disciplines within the Maintenance Operations Control Center. This will provide ample personnel in the MOC to assume the responsibility for the preventive maintenance task for tunnel fan operations from the ROC supervisor's console. 5 power supervisors have been hired. Once training is completed, the transition of taking over power functionality for scheduled maintenance work will begin. On the management side, the ROC is in the process of recruiting 3 additional superintendents. With the 3 additional superintendents, this will reduce the span of control and allow 24/7 coverage on all 3 shifts. We are also focusing on reducing distractions for the staff inside the rail control center. Metro is developing a scope of work to implement contractor recommended measures to reduce noise. Options including wrapping pillars with noise-reducing materials, applying sound-absorbing floor mats, and installing a glass apron for a situational area within the ROC to strategize during emergencies. As the power group takes over more maintenance activities, as discussed, we are developing a scope of work to construct a separate power room within the rail control center to create a more robust, isolated environment. We are also evening out our workloads created by mobile work gangs requesting track access by moving half of the track inspections to the night shift, and this has already been completed. New training, processes, and procedures will lead to the improvement of the rail control center. Metro is finalizing a computer-based training program that will utilize video to increase situational awareness for operators of both Class 1 and Class 2 vehicles and to provide system familiarization for rail control center controllers. An outside contractor, Power Rail, recently completed an overhaul of the ROC controller training program, which is now a module-based learning with exams for each section. If the exam for a module is not passed, the trainee does not move forward in the program. Recertification has also been revised to include a practical exercise. In addition to the Office of Emergency Management's quarterly regional exercises, the ROC is working with OEM to develop drills and exercises that are specific to the controller standard operating procedures. Checklists are being created and implemented, serving as guidelines to ensure that the proper steps are taken to adhere to our standard operating procedures. Audits are being performed and a repository of data has been created, which will assist in analysis and proactive identification of future training requirements. Actions are underway to support full staffing in the ROC. These include many of the activities I've already discussed, which will allow us to decrease the span of control of the controllers and managerial staff within the ROC, a concern for many of our various oversight agencies. In total, we are looking to add 33 positions to the Rail Control Center, and hiring has begun, prioritizing with controllers and supervisors first. We believe by the end of the third quarter, all six additional managers will be on board. Metro has contracted for temporary administrative support for the ROC as well. These resources will be used for maximal data entry and administrative duties to further reduce duties of the Rail Control Center supervisors. And finally, a compensation review is being conducted for all levels to slow down and stop the revolving door. The review will include evaluation of strategies such as retention bonuses and premium pay. Benefits include enhancing the candidate pool, attracting more qualified candidates, creating a competitive advantage, recognizing scarce skills, and addressing internal pay competitiveness. And finally, as we talked earlier about auditing, the Office of Quality Assurance, Internal Compliance, and Oversight is currently conducting a scheduled assessment of the ROC, approved by the General Manager in January this year as part of the 2017 QECO assessment plans. This assessment began in April of 2017 and will continue through the end of June of 2017. QECO's internal review of the ROC will assess the effectiveness of the methods and practices used to monitor and control traffic on the roadway and verify compliance with established procedures associated with the rail traffic controller's duties. QECO will provide immediate feedback to WMATA management on the results of these reviews to ensure that prompt action can be taken to address any concerns identified. Further, based on the results of these reviews, QECO will establish a scope for performing periodic ongoing reviews. And finally, we would just like to end with,
do you have the appendix on?
Oh, there it is. All right, with the number of CAPS. To date, there were a total of 40 CAPS between the FTA, the TOC, and the NTSB. 7 have been closed, 13 are currently under review. That means going back and forth with the various agencies, and 20 are in development. And with that, I'll open it up to any questions. Total numbers will be 61. 61.
Yeah, thank you for the report, and it's kind of in keeping with what Ms. Hudgens just mentioned. Can you share, since you've been here, sort of the progression, the staff progression in Iraq? I mean, particularly considering the move away from the ATC and sort of what that has meant, and you know, part of why we're going where we're going now. Going backwards a little bit, please.
In the control center in 1992, and it was a three console configuration as it is today. We are kind of, I don't want to strap, but we are governed by the radio frequencies. So how the lay of the land is basically by our radio ops 1, 2, and 3. There's a constant two-person control team on those consoles. They work knowing each other's position, and to this day, that is still how it is configured. Hopefully by the end of December of this year, we shall open up the fourth console, which will, as Joe mentioned, take away 13 stations and one major interlocking for the Silver Line and the Orange Line where they merge right there at East Falls Church. The workload of the controllers currently is that we do all of the power configuration for maintenance and emergencies. We're going to reduce that to give that to the power desk. And let them handle all the maintenance functions for removing power and let the controllers run the railroad. Also, the incidents that he mentioned also with the plant running, operating the fans workload on the controllers.
And if I could just jump in, when I look at other properties, and especially with my experience in New York City Transit, that is not unknown. In New York, we had a power control center that handled the power operations, and a lot of the fan work was performed by the parties that were responsible for the inspections of the fans. So a lot of the control centers are set up much differently, and this is the way we're looking to take our rock right now and put them into that scenario where the controllers will be dealing with service on a regular basis. In case of an emergency, they will still have the opportunity to handle the emergencies and have the ability to remove power when needed. However, when you look at scheduled maintenance work and stuff like that, that should be performed by other people and not by the controllers who are trying to run the service. And that's what we're trying to do. And it's very much like the models that other agencies have set up and established.
So just so that I understand, there's been no change in, I mean, as we've depended more on our people, has there been no change in sort of the requirements versus when we were utilizing ATC? Is that the case, that there is no change at all on the people?
Prior to what we want to do now, correct, there was no change. We were just giving more responsibility to the controllers. That's really what was happening.
Without adding anybody?
I'm sorry, it's a two-person console, and it has so one of the persons is called the traction power console or personnel, and that person works what we call the buttons, manipulating the interlockings, power functionality, making all the announcements. The other position is the radio controller that does all the direct conversation with trains or personnel that are put on roadway.
So those people were given a lot of responsibility, and that's some of what you're resetting now? Is that a bit better to understand it for me?
Correct.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very happy to see you're taking a look at the ROC and some of the policies and procedures. Is there any plans to go back to automated operation in the future to continue to reduce the workload of the operators?
Right now we have a task order out, and it's under capital programs to look at to ensure. We believe the last time that task order for Red Line was issued, they looked at safety certification based on the equipment in the field and not based on the environment overall. What I mean by that, Pat and I want to make sure that when we certify ATO to move forward, that it is in line with the way we do roadway worker protection. So until we get that task order completed and we get the results of that study, we'll be able to make a decision whether or not we can go back to ATO.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought when we had some of the APTA peer review in here, they took a look at the ROC. Is that correct?
Yes.
And they came up with some recommendations for the ROC. Have those been incorporated into this revamp?
Part of what we are doing was part of that peer review.
Okay. And I think it's a very interesting program, and I'd like to. For you to keep us up to date on this, you know, the ROC is very important to the operation of this property, and with roadway workers and all the work that's going on, the train control operators, they also provide a level of redundancy that's important, a safety redundancy for the people that are out along the right of way. And I know we've had a few issues recently, and hopefully that will improve with better training and less workload. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Yes, Mr. Walter.
Okay, I can't remember exactly when I was at the ROC last, but it was before the Silver Line opened in 2014. So you're telling us now that the console, that what I saw with my eyes was empty prior to Silver Line opening, has now been staffed?
The intention is now to staff it.
So Silver Line opened in 2014. Mm-hmm. It wasn't staffed. Now it is staffed?
It will be.
So the console's been sitting there at the ROC since 2013. Silver Line opened in 2014, and now we're just getting around to staffing the Silver Line console? Wow. Okay.
Mr. Splitter, just to follow up on Mr. Lobby on automatic train control. I had thought that about a year ago we received a briefing, maybe prior to your employment, that the red line would be returned to automatic train control during peak hours. Has that happened, and is that still the state of the red line?
We are not running right now ATO on any lines.
So we've gone back, and we're not running. What we were doing on the red line, we're no longer doing.
Correct.
And why is that?
I have to go back. I think there was an incident prior to our getting here that we stopped running an ATO. And I think when Pat and I got here and conferred over the roadway worker protection issue, we were concerned. The issue we have is that when you're in ATO and you have mobile gangs out on the right-of-way, you rely solely on the operator to pull his train out of ATO. There's no way from inside the rock to stop all trains to be in ATO. So there is a safety concern that we believe was when the system was first designed back in the 70s, okay? We cannot find any documentation when the safety certification was done that it was based on our current roadway worker protection and how we do business today. And until we're satisfied, Pat and I, that we have covered everything we need to do to ensure the safety of our employees, we do not want to run an ATO.
All right, now, I can appreciate why that's a big problem during SafeTracks where you have work going on. But will that problem continue after June 30th when SafeTracks ends?
When you say the problem, I'm not sure if I understand.
Problem of having gangs, roadway workers,
correct,
out on the right of way.
Yes, because we always have there. We have people that are doing inspections and different things throughout the day and throughout the night. So until we are satisfied that we've covered everything, that we have whatever technology we can do, whatever procedures we have in place, Pat and I feel it's better off not to be in ATO and stay in manual mode.
And so what's the timeline and the process to get to that point where we get back to where we were on the red line a year or 18 months ago?
Until we get the results of the study that's being done by a third party that can say whether or not ATO is from safety certification regarding RWP is correct, I will not know.
When
I need
will
to
that
get
happen?
That results.
What's the due
I would
date
say
for that report?
We're hoping by maybe the end of the third quarter.
End of the third quarter?
Yeah, that I would have the results. And then we'll have to look. I have to look
October
at what
1st.
They come across and see what they're recommending and stuff like that.
All right. Can you come back and
sure.
report back to us on that?
Will do.
Okay. The second issue is that it really goes to maybe it was Mr. Augustine on the missing employees, the vacancies in the ROC.
Yes.
You know, this has been a problem for the 3.5, 4 years that I've been here since the federal, whatever that was, safety oversight report, where they criticized us up and down for not having enough workers in the ROC, and we're still showing a gap of 33 employees. You made reference to a revolving door. Could you talk about that? What's the problem here? Is the revolving door really a revolving door where people get into a job and then leave it and go to some other place after a couple years? So we're a training ground for somebody else? What's the problem with hiring and retaining operators in the ROC?
Okay, first off, I'd like to say that the 33 positions we're talking about there are 33 new positions we're adding. So we're expanding the unit itself so that we could start to divide up the workload properly and to ensure that as we go with a powered desk and the maintenance away control center desk takes over some of the other responsibilities that they have the appropriate staff. So the 33 is in addition
to. So what you're saying is we did hire over the past 3 years a number of new controllers and they stuck. They stayed in employment with LaMotta.
Correct. Some have left. We've had retirements like everybody else goes through, okay? As I think one of the slides show, the average controller has a little bit under 3 years, you know, in the rail control center. You know, it is somewhat of a revolving door, you know, based on past incidents where we've had incidents and we had to discipline, where we've had retirees, where, you know, other attractive jobs within the authority because of the pay issue, you know, come about and they want to leave. So what we're looking to do from the compensation package is look at how can we make the job attractive enough that once we train them And when you think about the training, it's 25 weeks of training. Once we train them, how can we keep them? And that's what we're looking to do, and that's what this plan really covers.
Is the problem here that we're a training ground for air traffic controllers with the FAA, or are we a training ground for controllers going to other transit systems?
We're more of a training ground that people get a job and then go into other jobs within Metro. Okay? That's really what it is.
I mean, I might be thick about this, but it seems to me that the solution to that is a fairly easy one, is that you pay the guys more to keep them.
Right.
Am I missing something?
That's what we're looking to do. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, I just have three questions. The first pertains to the supervisors and the span of control and coverage. I seem to infer from the background that there are shifts that are uncovered by supervisors. Is that correct?
It was management. Would be what I would like.
Uncovered by a superintendent or manager.
Right. And what I'm looking to do as part of that is to beef up the managerial coverage so that we have a manager on all shifts.
Okay. So approximately what percentage of our shifts are uncovered by management?
Currently, there's one-third, so we have there's assistant superintendents on all shifts.
Yeah.
We do not have superintendents on coverage on all shifts. We have one-third on the midnight shift that is not covered completely at this time.
Okay. And so the overnight shift is uncovered currently? By a superintendent. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then with the slide that has the staffing levels current as compared to the expanded or proposed.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that one. I'm not following exactly where the plant fits into this. Plant? Yeah.
It's part of the MOC. They would fall under that.
So the +9, is that a real addition or is that a shift?
In addition.
Okay, so we currently have a plant maintenance team that is handling air supply and exhaust repairs, but they're not assigned to the ROC. They're not associated with the ROC. And so what you're saying is that group will. Which group is going to add the 9, the Maintenance Operations Center or the plant?
The Maintenance Operations Center, if you think about it, maintenance away, will have the various groups. So you'll have, we're looking to staff it where you have track people, ATC people, plant people. Okay, so it's a combination of. So when that unit eventually gets formed, it will be multidisciplined.
The MOC?
Yes.
And they will be the link to the larger complement of folks who work
are
in those disciplines.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so we have a plant team. It's just we need plant and other disciplines in that MOC.
Yeah.
Okay, so I get the organizational structure. And then with the MOC, is it fair to say, and this isn't criticism, but just to help me understand where we are, the focus is going to be on that maintenance operations center coordinating and resourcing the scheduled maintenance, not real-time issues that come up.
Correct. What happens is the scheduled maintenance will be done outside. It's being, you know, but when maintenance... when it's actually being executed, we're going to give those functions for whatever needs to be done. Track access, whether it needs to be, like we talked about the power desk will be pulling the power for those areas. That will be coordinated by those control desks in coordination with the ROC, which is done, like I said, in other agencies. Okay. However, the controllers for the ROC, the ones that run service, if there is an emergency, they will be full functional. They can do what they need to do, like they were currently doing now. But we're trying to take some of the scheduled stuff that is normal and allow them to handle the MLC desk and the power desk will handle the scheduled stuff. And it will allow the ROC controllers just to concentrate solely on moving trains.
Okay. So is it fair to say that the MOC will not as in the case of some other MOCs, will not be looking at diagnostics of how things are performing in real time, like picking up information about wheel flats or track faults or traction the power shoes and things like that, and then actually like deploying people to address issues as they emerge. That's not what they're going to be doing. You're just trying to get into the scheduled stuff.
The MOC desk is inside the rock itself,
right.
So they will know what's going on in the railroad. Okay, they will have first-hand knowledge, just like the rock controllers. So if there's an emergency that's going on, okay, we have a train that has wheel flats, so we have a signal problem or something like that, they'll be notified just like they are notified today, mm-hmm. Inside the rock that there's an issue, and they will make the appropriate calls to the divisions to say, we have an issue, please, dispatch people out.
Okay, so they will be involved in unscheduled deployment.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Okay, there's a whole set of other questions I would have about what we actually know about the railroad, but we can treat that in the future.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much on that presentation, and we'll get a report back after June and, of the progress. The next item that we have is Andy Hoff. Mr. Hoff is here. Yes, he's coming. Assistant General Manager for Rail, and he is going to give us a SafeTrack update and what we have been able to accomplish doing this project with preventive maintenance.
Good morning, ma'am.
Ms.
Laura Mason is going to start off the briefing talking about SafeTrack.
Good morning. we're here today to talk about the final report of the SafeTrack program, which I'm very pleased to state will be ending on June 25th as scheduled. As many of you know, SafeTrack started about a year ago, and it was all about a year of expanded maintenance windows. We had planned safety surges and a lot of focus on other areas. We included in it a moratorium on early openings and late closures, and we closed down weekend service at midnight. Over the past year, with these expanded windows, we've done over 3 years' worth of work. We've spent 386 days in total in SafeTrack, 307 days of surging, and within those surges, we've worked over 1.5 million job hours. What we've also done is invested a lot of your time, and before I go into the accomplishments of what we've achieved, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the sacrifice made across everyone in this region. There's no doubt that the entire region felt the impact of SafeTrack. It required an unprecedented level of collaboration across the region. I've heard from multiple stakeholders, both internal and external, that SafeTrack fostered new relationships as it forced us to communicate in new ways that we hadn't had to before. Looking more broadly, out of about 7,000 hours of service that we offer each year, over 5,800 of those hours were affected by SafeTrack. So over 80% of the time, somewhere on the system, our riders and our stakeholders were being affected by SafeTrack. But investing that time will yield savings for our riders through more reliable service, and we are already beginning to see the payoff of that investment. Over the last year, we've renewed one-third of the system's track structures. Prior to starting SafeTrack, over 22% of the wooden cross ties that hold our rails together, or 22% were defective. By the end of SafeTrack, we'll reduce that to under 2%. We have a noticeably smoother ride for those that commute through the areas we've surged in. You can feel the difference of the smoother ride. You can also hear it if you're in that neighborhood. The trains are quieter now as they move through. As one point of reference, prior to starting SafeTrack, there was a lot of attention on gauge rods. We had a peak of about 350 of them in the system. These are tools that are used as a temporary measure to hold the rails together when the structure isn't sound. We've gone from 350 to 9 as of the end of May. In addition, SafeTrack what happened beyond the surges. Those maintenance windows did affect the entire system. And through that expanded time, our traction power crews have been able to focus on orange boot replacement and cable replacement system-wide. And we're seeing that pay off in a reduction in smoke and fire incidents. Comparing the first 4 months of 2016, pre-SafeTrack, with that same time period in 2017, we've seen a 16% reduction in the number of incidents and a 32% reduction in the number of service hours lost due to fire and smoke incidents. Also, one other way we're seeing this time savings is a reduced number of emergency bus bridges. So when track is taken out of service unexpectedly in the middle of the day, we've had a 32% reduction in the number of emergency bus bridges we've had to call, comparing fiscal 17 with fiscal 16, and a 45% reduction in the number of hours of delay to our customers. So the volume of work done here is tremendous, and the time is paying off. On the next slide, I'll go through some of the numbers, but what I wanted to share first was to put this in scale. If you took all the cross ties replaced, which is over 50,000, you could build two of the Washington monuments. That is just how much work has been done here in the last 12 months. So let's dig into those numbers. The numbers you see on the screen here before you are the actuals. This is actual work completed through Surge 14, so we will add on to this Surge 15 and 16. The green bar represents the normal amount of work in a year. So for each of these key track components, we do a different number. So cross ties, a typical year pre-safe track was 15,000, whereas fasteners, we replaced 28,000. So if the green bar is normal, the blue bar shows what we plan to do under safe track, and the orange and yellow shows what we actually did. So you can see that we are already at three times the amount of cross ties replaced in a year, and four times on the grout pads. So safe track has really been about fixing this fundamental structure of our tracks. So digging just a little further into those, I do think it's worth understanding the work that's been accomplished and what safe track has meant to our crews and our productivity. On the cross ties, we get three times more production this year. Pre-safe track, we used to do cross ties primarily on the weekends, because in a normal overnight window, you get 5 to 10 ties. In a weekend, you could do about 300. So we used to achieve 300 ties per week. When we have been using these safety surges where we have continuous 24/7 track access, we can get 1,000 ties per week per crew. And in larger areas, we're able to mobilize multiple tie gangs. Grout pads, similarly, we're seeing three times productivity when we have these safety surges. Pre-safe track, we only did grout pad replacement on the weekends. And for those of you who aren't yet familiar with grout pads, I should stop and point out those pictures on the right-hand side. The grout pads are small pads of concrete, of grout, that are used to hold the rail at the precise elevation and angle that it needs to be in for that specific location of track. So they sit on top of the structure itself to hold the rail in the right location. Prior to safe track, we did 400 feet per week. Within a surge, we can do about 2,000 feet in a week. So it's really been tremendous productivity. So coming out of safe track, we've accomplished a lot of work. We've restored many parts of our system that were truly deteriorated into a safer, stable state. And we can enable ourselves to be in a place where we can maintain that through our annual capital renewal program without needing a program quite like this. Safe track has been the most aggressive track renewal program in WMATA's history, and it's took a tremendous amount of hard work and cooperation from employees, riders, and stakeholders. It has triggered major changes to how WMATA operates. We have a new track inspection manual that was developed over the past year. We've created a new maintenance of way engineering department that will be working with those maintenance groups, bringing more data into the planning of maintenance so we can improve how we plan it and how we execute this work. We've also revised a lot of the standard operating procedures that surround how we access our tracks. But above all, the most important lesson coming out of Safe Track is the need to maintain a proactive and sustained maintenance program. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Off, who will tell you what we're going to do next year in FY18.
Thank you very much, Laura. As Laura has spoken about what's happened in the past, we're going to turn the focus of the briefing and look ahead. As the slide notes, the two major components we feel are necessary to avoid a Safe Track 2.0 type rehabilitation exercise. First and foremost is the preventive maintenance program, which we'll be executing within our extended hours of non-passenger service, and second being a much more robust and aggressive capital program that gets after those two primary elements, one being those components that age out regularly year after year, ties, grout pads, fasteners, and then those other facility-type projects, whether it be leak mitigation or platform rehabilitation. As the slide notes, And as we discussed in our preventive maintenance briefings, this is all about, you know, righting the triangle and making preventive maintenance the foundation of maintaining our assets, supplemented by an aggressive capital program. And then, of course, there will always be some degree of corrective maintenance. Just to recap, the purpose of preventive maintenance, certainly to improve the safety of the system, in turn the reliability, and extend the life of those assets. Just to frame this, the types of failures that we experience in the system, that's how, you know, is the launching point for creating the preventive maintenance program. Certainly smoke and fire will continue to hold ourselves to a target of zero due to the severity of those incidents. Second being the track infrastructure itself, both as it relates to proper wheel-rail interface and ensuring the wheels stay on the rails, and second being the geometry and the foundation, whether that be ties or fasteners. The picture to the right, you know, generally is noted, as you'll see in the appendix, our six preventive maintenance programs are distributed amongst the three functions, track, geometry, and smoke and fire. From a risk-based approach, the y-axis notes the severity of an incident. The x-axis notes the probability. So you can see the way we've allocated our resources and designed our programs is based on a risk-based approach. We're certainly smoke and fire being the less probable but higher catastrophic events, and then moving to the right. So when we look at the types of incidents we've had, lay them out from a risk-based approach and determine how we best allocate our resources to include track time. For the sake of brevity, I am not going to go through each one of our six preventive maintenance programs, but I did want to share how we intend to hold ourselves accountable moving forward. As one example, this is our track geometry or tamping and surfacing program, where we consolidate the rock and correct the alignment of the rails. On the bottom left is a graph. The squiggly diagonal red line notes how many incidents we've experienced cumulative over fiscal year 17, so it increases as the fiscal year progresses. The flat horizontal line is a 50% reduction in those instances. So what we intend to do is, over the course of FY18 and FY19, to track how many incidents we experience as an effect of the track geometry preventive maintenance program, plot that, and our goal is to show that over 2 years we'll be able to reduce those number of incidents by 50%. From a production perspective, the bottom right-hand corner shows our schedule, where the orange notes where we intend to tamp in first quarter of FY18. The yellow notes where we intend to tamp for the remainder of the fiscal year, and then the uncolored lines note direct fixation sections of the railway where we wouldn't be doing that. So going forward, this is how we intend to update on progress in terms of incidents and reducing the probability of those unscheduled delays and also schedule. Now turning our focus to the need for a robust capital program, as I referenced prior, we generally put this into two buckets, those reoccurring assets that require replacement every year forever. And secondly, those larger type projects, whether they be platform rehabilitation or leak mitigation type projects. And as we look at how we determine how to schedule this work, there are obviously many variables that come into play, but most specifically, the physical constraints we have. Certainly there's just some work that you can't get done when you occupy the same space. The nature of the work, whether it be major concrete pours or a simple fastener replacement, and then, of course, the magnitude. Our capital planning process. So this year we have produced a year-long FY18 track access schedule where we note who's working when on the railroad. The way we went about this process was we first fenced off those times that we know working is not good for our customers. Cherry blossom, and some of the major other events that happen in the Capitol. Then we first try and maximize our weekend work. As was discussed in the ROCC briefing, we have 3 to 4 operations channels. Due to controller span of control, we don't like to plan more than one work zone on each one of those, so we intend to maximize every weekend and have one work zone on each line with no more than one shutdown. Then, of course, we attempt to coordinate work so we can combine more than one group in the same work zone. Our intent in FY18 is to limit daytime work. We've found that to be inefficient from a work production perspective and also extremely disruptive to our PM rush cycle. And also we are getting away for 8 p.m. early outs and moving to a pre-safe track 10 p.m. early out type model. And then, of course, planning these more strategic, targeted, longer-term outages that are needed to get after some of these unique components that require that type of time and space to execute. Our FY18 rail infrastructure capital program, the intent of this slide is just to present a high-level flavor of what work we intend to execute in FY18. On the left-hand side, you'll see those major capital-type projects that we intend to carry out. Structural repairs at Rhode Island Avenue, continuing work from this past fiscal year. Canopy repairs at both White Flint and West Hyattsville. Drainage pumping stations, that infrastructure that nobody sees that's very critical in moving, you know, a few million gallons of water out of our system on a daily basis. Then those things within the fence line or the right-of-way, of course, the radio program, continuing to put a lot of, good effort and access time into that critical program. The Orange-Blue Line rehabilitation project that's continuing to focus on ceiling tiles and traction power-type facilities. The lighting rehabilitation project, which includes relamping all the tunnels. And the Red Line leak mitigation pilot project. This is a project that is not yet finalized. We're aggressively trying to find a way. We've identified a unique technology that looks very hopeful, that is much more efficient than previous proposals. So we're working hard with them, coordinating with internally, and once we get a good handle on this pilot program, that will something we'll certainly share. But the intent is this will not be a production-type project. It's simply a pilot to validate the use of this technology. And then, of course, our annual track renewal program, where we'll continue to get after ties, fasteners, and at the bottom here, our interlockings. I think so these are our three two-week strategic outages that we plan for FY18, the Branch Avenue interlocking, the Tacoma interlocking, and the Huntington interlocking. The next three slides show the details of these three strategic outages, the first one being in the summer between Branch Avenue to Naylor Road, August 5th to August 20th. During this time, we'll replace the entire double crossover to include all the concrete underneath it that supports it. In addition to that, we plan to replace approximately 3,500 cross ties within this work zone. And as we've learned through the end of SafeTrack, we're doing this as a shutdown to both, A, run better reliable service. We've been able to deliver, service the way we've planned it when we do these shutdowns, and also to provide better quality work in a faster time period. Next slide. Our fall project, Silver Spring to Fort Totten, similar type of shutdown model. We will change out the entire Tacoma interlocking and also do ties. Next slide. And then in late spring, another terminal interlocking, very critical for our operation at Huntington, where we'll shut down between Huntington and basically Huntington and Eisenhower in order to replace that interlocking and all the underlying concrete, at which time we will be running Yellow Line service out of Franconia on the same headway as it would be leaving Huntington. Next slide. So our next steps, as Laura noted, on Sunday, June 25th, is our last and final day of SafeTrack. From there, we'll launch into our new strategy on how we're going to maintain our railroad, being both preventive maintenance and an aggressive capital program. In November, using some of the tools that we presented here, we expect to return to share with the team how we've done in terms of production and schedule on our preventive maintenance program, and also begin to start showing some of the graphs on incidents, and then, of course, using our on-time performance and infrastructure availability metrics. And pending any questions, that concludes our briefing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. And I want to start by thanking Ms. Mason for the message that you sent to the customers, because and to the workers as well, because we know the impact that it has had on SafeTrack, and we hope that as a result that they'll see a safer and a more convenient and reliable system. But as we go into the, your presentation, Mr. Pavick, the expectations are that we have to have these others, and that, that is in their schedule, and the expectation should be the same as they've had before in terms of the shutdown scheduling, reduced times, and all of that. And I think that that the question that we'd all ask is, okay, we know that we have brought the system back to a much better performance by the large amount of time that we've invested there. We are now scheduling a level of shutdowns, and will the level of shutdowns be where we think we'll have to be forever? That is, will, until we can determine what is truly the state of good repair and be able to maintain that.
Yes, ma'am. Our plan, as with FY18, is to continue to schedule the work in you know, in a very logical way. If it requires shutdown to get it done, then I think we'll certainly pursue that and present that to both Mr. Lear and the general manager.
Okay. Questions? I'll sure. Start with Mr. Mel.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the report and for putting all of it together, and particularly in the two different parts. And I would say, Mr. Off, that on the I'm looking at the bias, and it shows here sort of like who's going to do the work in addition to, you know, what the work will be. And I have to ask, and it's a very comprehensive thing. I mean, I appreciate the fact that you have shared some about what SafeTrack was, but we need, I think the board needs a much more comprehensive readout of the program as a whole, which would share how much we spent on it, how we spent it. We spent some of it with our employees. How much of it was spent on contractors? You know, how did we do it? That talks about whether, you know, from the safety aspect, also the quality control of the work that was done. I know we had some stops and starts along the way. We want to get that, and to be able to better understand that and take a picture of it. And part of the reason why I say this is because I've spent a significant amount of time looking back at what Metro has done and some of the plans, and some of this stuff has been done before. And we need to feel, I want to see this and be able to memorialize it to say, you know, there was a need, there was an identification of a three-year track renewal program, I want to say like 10 years ago. And they said that they were doing a three-year track renewal program. But we're doing it again now. And including cross ties, and I'm not sure that the life of a cross tie is 3 years. I would hope that it's longer than that. So I really feel that we need that comprehensive piece, Mr. Wiedefeld, that talks about all three aspects, the what was done, how much it cost, the safety implications and the benefits that we get more comprehensively, although I'm appreciative of what the presentation was here today. I just ask that we see that as an output when we are done with this program. Thank you.
We'd be glad to pull that together and just give it to the board.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I think that's the first time I've ever seen the Washington Monument in railroad ties, and that's quite a visual there. You know, yes, I think we do need some more details on this, but really I'm impressed with SafeTrack and what's happened here. SafeTrack came about because we identified a serious problem, and Mr. Wiedefeld and his staff get credit for identifying that problem and making the tough decision to actually go into this emergency track renewal program. And a plan was put together, it was implemented, it was changed to make things better, make things more efficient, and a significant amount of improvement has happened. And this is a good news story. I read some of the newspapers and they say, well, what's the difference? I don't feel any difference. Well, I'm on the Orange Line every day, and I feel the difference. We don't have slow orders. It's a smooth ride. The quality of the work has been excellent. I always stop at West Falls Church before I get on the train and inspect the ties, and I can't find any bad ties anymore. I used to find hundreds of them. But anyhow, this is really a good program. It's really a legacy for Mr. Wiedefeld to take this on, and I think it was very well done. And it gives me confidence that these additional programs that have to be done, that they're going to be done right, and that we are doing the right things to right the ship of WMATA, and that we're on the road to give Washington, D.C. the world-class transit system that they deserve. So thank you very much for this hard work, and I'm very impressed. Let's see the details, but congratulations on a job well done.
I would just echo that. I think Safe Practice was well done. Congratulations there. But now I want to shift the focus and talk about the program going forward. And I guess to do that, I want to just pop up there the slide that has FY18 capital planning process. As I understand your presentation, going forward after July 1, the non-rev evening hours are going to be used for preventive maintenance, basically testing the various systems and components that you've described, but that the actual capital work is going to be largely done, as your slide indicates, on weekend hours, aside from there's 3 hours of work during daylight that you described as well. And my concern there is that we've lost a lot of ridership since 2009, the last 8 years, and the loss of ridership has not just been Monday through Friday and during peak days and peak hours. It's also been on the weekend as well. It's been on the weekend because our construction program has resulted in a lot of single tracking, you know, a lot of station closures where we've had to have bus bridges, and we've had longer waits between trains at stations. And I'm concerned that we're just going to continue this pattern of putting the burden on the weekend rider and the weekend hours that we've experienced for the last few years. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to sort of shift that a little bit and find some other times to find hours for the capital program that don't put all the burden on the weekend hours. I mean, what I'm thinking about is that I see you've picked up times in August, November, and May. But how about the period from Christmas through New Year's? During that period when ridership is fairly low, that would seem to be a good time to be able to get out there for 2 weeks and get some work done and take some of that pressure off of the weekend riders, as well as a more aggressive program for summer of next year, 2018. And so I want your comments on that and whether you can sort of come back to us with, if not options, at least showing us how many hours of work are really going to be done on weekends, and whether some of that can be shifted to other times during the year.
Okay, if I could start, Andy, if you want to jump in. I think what we tried to do here today is give you a very high level view of and highlight some of the projects. I don't want anybody to walk away today and think that we will not do capital work at night. There will be some capital work that can be done on the overnight hours and in some of the extended hours. There will be. But I think it's a delicate balance when you start planning, and there's a lot more jobs that are going to be done than what we showed you today. And what we try and do is during that scheduling period is to look at what's more cost effective. Some work could be done on an overnight hour, but then we'd extend it for so many, for so long, it becomes so, ineffective. You'll be driving the cost of the projects way up, where you can get in there in a larger window and get it done much quicker and get out. The three jobs that were highlighted, I think we picked because of their locations, is school out, things like that. That was the time. We could look at other alternatives, things that come to mind depending on the type of work and how much work has to come, or three-day weekends. Could some work be done on three-day weekends or four-day weekends, depending on how the holidays fall in? And that can be done. And that would depend on the type of work, where it's located. that's critical, and just how the calendar falls. But we will. We will look at that.
I mean, you haven't presented this as something that the board has to decide on, but I would encourage you to sort of see if you can push some of this so we can give some greater sense of reliability to people who are going to use the system on the weekend, so we'll be doing something to increase and encourage greater ridership on weekends, which I think is now discouraged by the sense that there's always something going on out there, and therefore there's going to be station closings, and I don't want to take bus bridges, and I don't want to have to wait a half an hour for a train. Give people some assurance that what we set out there as our set times between trains will be something that they can rely on. I think we'll help it and we'll encourage ridership on the weekend hours.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Off and Ms. Mason, thank you for that presentation. I want to second Mr. Lobby's words here. I think it is definitely impressive and encouraging as we go into this equally as important second phase of work. But I did have one question, and when I'm on the blue and yellow line, I see it every day, and I want to get a sense at some point of the station platforms. The National Airport is the one that I see most often, the edges of the platforms being propped up. Get some sort of sense of how many stations have platform issues and the severity of those issues, and what's the plan to address some of that?
Thank you, sir. Yes, we do have numerous platforms with challenges being supported by shoring. They've been evaluated, by our team, and it is a safe platform. It's just, the edge of it at places is crumbling. It is something that our engineering team is aggressively pursuing. They're spending FY18, this coming fiscal year, creating design solutions specifically for platforms such as King Street, Braddock Road, and National Airport. And our expectation is that we will see some of that work in the FY19 capital program.
Thank you.
Yes.
Again, I want to add my comments to congratulating all of you on a successful completion of the program. The question I'm going to get from everybody over there when we're done, and we're going to be, they approach things in a very soundbite simple way, okay? And the question is this: after all that's been done on SafeTrack and we've finished it, and all the planning and projects that we have to look forward to that is going to cause disruptions, what can I tell the riders about reliability? All the things that people are concerned about, price, safety, et cetera, the issue that's most important to our riders is reliability. I ride the train every day. When I get on and I get off at work, what percent of the time am I going to be late for work? And do we have data that shows that? My understanding is that 69% of our trains arrive on time, meaning 31% don't. Is that gotten better since this? Is it going to be better since this? So what, in a very capsulized terms, can I tell my riders on June 26th, now that SafeTrack is done, what to expect going forward?
Okay, I think at the last vital signs, we showed that the reliability of track has, or the infrastructure has improved. So I think what we'll see after SafeTrack ends, that we'll see a continuation of the improvement of our infrastructure. To say that we'll never have a delay as a result of a failure is just impossible. I think you'll see the on-time performance. I think some of that had to do with the existing schedules. So it wasn't just all related to the delays. It was a combination of a lot of things. It was the existing schedules that were in place that were not adequate, as well as the infrastructure delays that dropped the on-time performance. So I think, as we see the schedule changes that we have in place for the start of June 26th, I think we'll eventually start to see, as reliability and everything improves. We saw the reliability of the cars greatly improve from 55,000 up to where, in cases, we're up near 80,000 already. We're going to see that continue. That means less offloads. That means we're going to see reliability of the system improve, and you will see on-time performance improve. How quickly and what the measure is, I can't tell you right now.
I can just add something. I just want to check with Dan. We're now monitoring the tap-in, the actual time that someone taps in and taps out. And for 91% of the time, we're within 5 minutes of the schedule. To think that we could achieve that on the highway system would be amazing. But, yeah, we're doing it on transit.
Very much for the presentation and for the work that's done. And I think it's sort of like that the patient was really, really sick and that it's better and that we'll have to keep working toward this for it to get well. And I think that's going to – I think the chairman's question is a very good question and to our riders, but I think where we have been is so substantially different than where we are now. How do we get a unified program that's going to keep us there and return the system to the other? And I would say that we have to get through FY18, which is most important, and I think the riders now have some expectations for FY18 that they will be able to judge us by, and we'll have to come back. Thank you very much for the presentation, and if there are no other questions, we are adjourned. Thank you.